Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You have my sword.
And you have my bow.
And my trowel.
Hi, and you're listening to episode 12 of And My Trowel, where we look at the fantastic side of archaeology and the archaeological side of fantasy. I'm Ash.
And I'm Tilly.
Today, we're going to be looking at a mythical figure, a creature made from the wilds and winds who has control over creation and has an affinity with the weather. She, of course, is the Cailleach. You got it, Tilly?
I'm definitely going to pronounce that wrong throughout the whole of this episode. I apologise in advance to anyone listening.
I also apologise. I don't have a lot of Gaelic, so I'm just going off it. Like, yeah, this is how you pronounce it. Right, so now many people might not have heard of her or know her by name, unless maybe you live in Scotland or Ireland, because she's a big figure in Celtic mythology. But you will have heard of her. So let me give you a clue. She's a giant ancestress, a mother of mountains. She sculpts landscapes with her giant steps and she drops rocks to form mountains from her wicker basket. She's one-eyed, white-haired, dark blue skin and rust-coloured teeth. She is the personification of winter, fighting off spring in an eternal battle. She is what her name means. She is a divine hag.
A divine hag. So that's Cailleach is divine hag.
It's Cailleach. Cailleach is old woman, actually. Sometimes you can think it's actually like old crone, wise woman. Yeah.
So kind of like a witch?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
I'm just thinking of... You knew I was going to bring it in, right, Ash?
Oh, God.
So it's Terry Pratchett's Discworld.
It's Terry Pratchett hour.
They call the wee free men are like the little, they're called Pixies. Not Pixies, but Pixies.
Oh,
which
nice.
I find hilarious. We might have to do an episode on them. And they call witches hags. Like, that's their word for a witch. So I guess that's rather than like, but is it always an old woman?
Always an old woman, yes. Okay. Like, for instance, my partner's grandmother will call herself a Cailleach.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She's like, I'm just a Cailleach. So she'll say that all the time. Or she's like, I'm just a silly Cailleach. Stuff like that. Huh. So she is an older woman. And so she'll refer to herself as an old woman. So if you think about a lot of European folklore traditions, though, hags are usually older women who have affinity with like witchcraft and nature. But they always, always have sovereignty attached to them. Mm. They're respected and they're feared. Mm. But where do hags come from? What does their appearance in our folklore traditions tell us about how people interpret the landscape? So, Tilly, have you ever read anything that features a Cailleach or a divine hag?
Not necessarily a Cailleach. And to be honest, I hadn't heard of it before you mentioned it as well when you were saying, oh, we could do an episode on the Cailleach. And I had to do a whole, oh, right, yeah, mm-hmm. Remind me again.
So you just rolled off your tongue there. You weren't even noticing.
Cailleach. Yeah. Just naturally born with the Scottish tongue. Technically, was born in Scotland, although even though I have probably no Scottish heritage. So, you know, we'll see. Yeah, so I haven't necessarily read anything, I don't think, that features the Cailleach. But as I say, I have read the Terry Pratchett series does have a witches series in it. And there's a lot in that about, you know, if you don't have respect, you don't have nothing. And the head witch is very much feared by the locals as well, but then also has that respect of it and all this kind of thing. And I think, I'm trying to think of other books I've read which have kind of fantasy elements with the big hat. And they're pretty much in nearly every kind of fantasy series, I guess. There's always some kind of creepy old lady who sort of is in the background telling things. Like, you know what I mean? In that kind of book, like there's a certain kind of fantasy, I think, where that's there. And there's always sort of some, it's almost not necessarily respected in those kind of books, I feel. It's just fear.
But whereas fear is also a type of respect in some way, a healthy modicum of fear.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah. Whereas I feel like, and I know,
It's the problem is there's like 25 books in that series, right? So of course I'm going to find something to get them from.
To be fair, though, I mean, Terry Pratchett's Discworld series does have a lot of witches
things.
And hags and great hags in them. So, you know, weird sisters, they are technically hags.
Well, and my favorite part of those ones is that they can do magic and, you know, that kind of thing. But they don't a lot of the time. It's just, what's the word they use? Headology, they use, is the word. So it's basically persuading people that they're going to get better. Like, almost like placebo effect, basically. So they give them, you know, agros sucros or whatever. And it's just like water and sugar, you know. But they take it and they think that it's going to be better. So it's that kind of, because people respect them and know that they will make them better, if they give them something, they're going to make them better. And I think there's some scene somewhere where, you know, the person is like, really, is that everything? And, you know, it's Granny Weatherwax is going, yes, and you have to lie on a board of oak seasoned over 20 years and, you know, do all this thing to get the, and he's going, oh, so the knots will go from my back to the wood. And it's like, oh, Granny hadn't thought of that. That was a good one for later, you know, kind of thing. it's that, the whole aspect of that mixture of fear and respect. But then, so people don't necessarily like the witches, but they know they're a good thing. So I guess that's similar to the kayak. It's sort of that thing. You wouldn't necessarily be like, oh, what a lovely person, but you know she's necessary.
She's very necessary. She creates and sculpts the whole landscape that we live in. She's the whole point of winter and, you know, life, really.
Yeah,
she creates it. But I think that that's an interesting thing, because we look at divine hags or we look at kayaks and we look at even like Baba Yaga and stuff, that, you know, these witches, these women, these wise women, and we see them as a negative thing in modern society, but actually they weren't. It was never a negative thing. So we're getting a bit feminist here, but, like, you know,
of course we are
feminists, but you know, so we see this kind of as a scary thing. A hag is a scary thing. You'll see them kind of characterized, especially in like D&D, they're usually creepy old scary women who have green skin and warts and try to take children and make terrible potions and kind of trick you.
But I mean, that's to be fair, the kayak has blue skin and rust colored teeth. I mean, that's also not exactly.
Yeah. It's not. She doesn't have to be attractive. She's a sculptor of mountains, for goodness sake. But that's like, true. You know, but that's how I think it's changed, and that's because of the heavy influence of the patriarchy as well. Mm-hmm. So these women were highly respected. Well, they were in modern society as well, hags. Like, you know, they're wise women. They're also midwives, doctors, things like that. Any woman that has, you know,
some kind of power or knowledge, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But they do relate to their landscape. They always relate to nature. They always relate to the wider world. Mm-hmm. So do you have a favourite depiction of a kayak or a divine hag?
I mean, it probably is, to be honest, the Terry Pratchett witches. I think that's the closest that I would come, because indeed it is. And like you say, they relate a lot to the landscape, to the land, to an understanding. Even the first book that they're introduced in, Weird Sisters, and it's all about the kingdom is unhappy with the current king. It's sort of a play on Hamlet. And yeah, so it's talking about the landscape and how the animals react, but also the trees and the mountains and everything. And they sort of talk about how all the different growing stages of the different aspects of the landscape and everything, and how that's related, which I think is really interesting, you know, to actually go into that detail of that kind of thing. I'm trying to think if there was a witch in, a female witch in Lord of the Rings?
No.
I don't think there is, right? I'm trying to think. I haven't read the Silmarillion and stuff, so I don't know if there is any in the kind of bi stories, so to speak. But I'm trying to think, and I feel like in that one, because that would be one where it's always a male figure kind of being the
wise
winter,
and character.
Wise
winter,
landscape.
Powerful.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Which is interesting.
Well, in Lord of the Rings, it seems like the Istari, the kind of wizards who include Gandalf and Saruman, Radagast, and the Blue Wizards, they're all men. They don't see, because they have the bodies of men being colloquial for humans. Mm-hmm. But he did use that word and then referred to it, you know, as men. But it seems that generally, it seems like Tolkien's conceived all the kind of magical beings as male in that sense. So any kind of sovereignty figure that we have, a wise and older person. They're all men in Tolkien,
which is interesting, only, right? Because, like you say, in folklore, there's a lot about women. Like, wizards aren't really a thing in folklore, are they?
Not really. I mean, there's definitely magical users who are men. I mean, it doesn't really have a gender to it. I'm thinking of Scottish mythology and Irish mythology. Mm-hmm. You do have magical users, but you also have magical users who are tricksters, and sometimes they're usually men.
Right. Yeah.
So they're kind of these like immortal masculine spirits and stuff that you get. And I think maybe he's kind of gone into that a little bit more, but a lot of the kind of folklore mythology that Tolkien uses is interesting because they're not really. I always think of the blue men and the blue wizards, and we have blue men in Scotland, but they're usually associated with the sea. So it's just interesting that you look at these different kinds of magic identities, and then Tolkien's kind of gone a totally different way from it, but that also reflects the time that he's writing in, because he is writing about wars as well. That his whole thing is about World War One, isn't it, and his experiences and stuff. So it will be a very male dominated frontline kind of a narrative that doesn't necessarily, but also there's only like two women.
Right? Have you seen that? There's some video about I can't remember what it is. It's like, here's a video of all the times that a woman speaks to another woman in the Lord of the Rings films. And you've got like a 2 second clip where that little girl goes, "Where's Mama?" And Eowyn goes, "Shh." And that's it.
The end. Definitely. And there's the outside stories as well, where he talks, it's about him and his wife and their love and all that kind of stuff. But it's not very sweet.
It's interesting indeed how the different, and actually that's referenced a bit in the Terry Pratchett one too, because you also have wizards in Discworld and witches, and there's a lot of, like, the witches think that wizards are just pompous old fools in their university who don't actually know how the world works and, all this kind of stuff. Whereas the wizards think that the witches are just, common hags who, can't deal with the bigger magics and only deal with sort of hedge witch, magic. So I guess there is, right? There's that sort of association in modern fantasy of that, like of a woman, like a Kalach, which, but then you say she moves mountains and things. I mean, that's powerful magic to me. I guess you still have in a lot of modern fantasy books, it's more, the witch is more kind of, she'd be a sorceress if she's really powerful, but just sort of the old hag, the old lady witch has a bit of a different connotation, I would say.
Yeah, and you've got to remember with the Kayak, she is winter. She is the landscape. She is the creator of things. So, like, she does create mountains, and she literally, like, will use the landscape as stepping stones. And as she moves, the landscape, like, she creates it with her feet. Mm. She also calls in winter because she has certain things that she'll do, certain rituals. So she'll collect firewood, and if an extra day she's still collecting firewood on a certain day in spring, you know that winter's like still going. Or vice versa, She also has stuff where, she's got this big plaid cloth and you must wash it. She must wash it, and it takes 3 days to wash. And only then will she call in winter.
Oh.
Once it's nice and white and pristine.
Okay.
So the stuff like that it's very much rooted in folklore. It's rooted in people's traditions and people, how they're moving around the landscape and how they're interpreting in that landscape through a divine being.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tilly, that brings us to our quest today.
Exciting.
So I woke up this morning, foul mood, obviously, feeling extremely cold. I could see my breath crystallizing on the air. I was shivering in my duvet, and I dragged myself out of bed, opened my curtains, and saw that there was a thick layer of frost outside, everywhere, covering the back garden. And when I looked closely, there was actually a herd of deer staring back at me from the recesses of those gloomy trees. But in the center of the frost lay a great, dark, plaid wad of fabric. No, I'd heard stories like this before. I've just told you the story. And I feel like the Kayak had clearly visited me in the dead of night, and she gave us a task to complete. Okay. So I chucked on some boots. I went outside, grabbed the great old dirty plaid, and on top there was a note that said, Bera left her plaid at home. It needs to be washed. Take it to the cauldron so she can usher in winter again. Signed, Baltok.
But hang on. I mean, it is nearly spring, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. But honestly, my toes were freezing and I'm really not sure. I want to invite the wrath of the kayak on our heads. So I think we have a mission. We have to traipse across the landscape, find this cauldron, deliver the winter plaid to the kayak. But first, as archaeologists, we need to find and figure out where in the world she might be. But before we go into more detail on that, let me just reconsult my rune stones and we'll be back with you soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back. So I looked at the runes and it seems to me and Tilly that the most interesting way we could approach finding the kayak is through landscape archaeology. Specifically, we can look at both the natural and cultural environment to help us in our search.
But what is landscape archaeology?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Landscape archaeology is a multidisciplinary approach to archaeological theory. So it looks at the way people in the past constructed and used their environment around them, such as a site's relationship between material culture, human activity, land and cultural modifications to the site, and the natural environment around it too.
Okay.
Yeah. Landscape archaeologists, they look at these choices people make about how and where to live and what types of settlements or buildings they build and what types of food they can grow and eat. So we'd be looking at two things that impact each other: the natural environment, topography and climate and soils, while also looking at the cultural world created by humans, such as place names, customs, traditions that are central to these landscapes. So to make it simple, we're looking for areas of natural and cultural landscape importance that the kayak has had an impact on, and so we follow that trail.
But hang on, okay, so this might sound a little bit silly, but like when you say landscape, so you mentioned like names and stuff, but I mean, isn't landscape just kind of mountains and trees and things?
Oh, yeah, I see. I got ahead of myself there. Okay, yeah, you're correct. So all these things include the landscape, definitely, but also the place. It's the place, right, where we as humans choose to inhabit. So where you are right now, listening to us listeners, that is part of your landscape. It has meaning because you are there. The landscape archaeologists begin every investigation with the principle that the landscape was and is meaningful. So you have chosen to be there, to build and live there because of the conjunction between nature and culture. That is our landscape.
So do you mean like the particular region? So like my street, or would it be like my house or my room? Like how big or how small is it?
It's really a spatial kind of thing. So yeah, all of that. So you'd look at the larger landscape, which is the place you are in. So like the county you're in, why you're there. Then you kind of narrow it down and we look at the more spatial aspect of stuff. So why are you in these four walls right now? What activities are you doing within these four walls? And you can kind of trace people's steps and how they go about their life through landscape archaeology.
Okay. And like, because, so for example, at the moment, I'm living in a house that my husband's grandparents built. Like, so is the landscape, is it also time dependent? Like, would my definition of landscape, this is getting very deep, like, would my definition of landscape be different to their definition of landscape? Or is it only the physical thing? Like, how how linked is it to the people or to the place, if that makes sense?
It's intertwined. So yeah, okay. Landscape changes, and that's because society changes, the meaning changes, but it's still meaningful. So why you choose to, you know, live in your landscape is maybe not the same reason why, you know, your Michael's grandparents or why the Neolithic people chose to live there, but they are still both interconnected because you still inhabit that space. Right?
And is that like, sorry, I keep asking questions.
I like it.
I'm genuinely interested in this because I haven't really, I did like one module on landscape archaeology when I was in my undergrad, but it's not really something that I've gone into in a lot of detail, and I know that you have more experience in this, so I'm taking the opportunity.
I don't think I have much more experience.
Well, you did landscape stuff, but it's sort of that, because I guess it's that idea of, because you mentioned sort of Neolithic and the landscape, but is it still basically, would someone who's, so for example the Kalach, would someone who lives in that region and understands it, the landscape, but has no real understanding of the history or the folklore, how would their interpretation be more or less appropriate, I guess is the word I'm using, than, for example, someone who doesn't really know the landscape but knows a lot about the folklore and the stories about the Kalach and that side of it? Like, how much of it is based in the actual physical part? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Well, I suppose, I mean, both are interesting concepts, but if you're living in the physical landscape, you understand it more than when you don't.
Okay.
Right? Because you know the paths, you know the way the nature works around you, you know what animals and how, what plants and flora and fauna grow, but that means you're interacting with it on a different level than someone who doesn't live in the landscape. So it's kind of similar to, you know, you talk about community building, and when archaeologists go into different communities, we need to have an understanding of that community, and we need the community on our side because they're important, because they live in that landscape. So that's part of landscape archaeology. For someone who knows about the area and you know, has never been, the best thing to do is to do walkovers. So for if you're trying to find a site, you know it's sort of in this area, you're not too sure what you can find. You know there was activity, though, because someone maybe sometime found something like a hammer or something in the landscape. Then what you do is you do like a walkover survey and you tag any sort of site that you think might be of importance. And that could just literally be a lump in the ground and you think, looks like a stone. But why is it there? And it was a line of stones. That looks like a little bit of a dwelling of some kind. So you'd put a tag in it and then we'd come back and start looking at it and plot these things. And that's how you can start to understand the landscape and how people moved around it. Does that answer your question?
It does. It does. Yeah.
Cool.
So I guess in terms of the Kalach, it would have to be, we'd need to know about the stories about her, because you mentioned... The one thing I could remember from what you mentioned earlier was that she dropped stones to make mountains. So I guess following a mountain range would be a good way to start. Or am I thinking too literally now?
No, you are. That's exactly what it is. So place names, right? Mm-hmm. So place names mean that people associate those areas with her. Okay. Mm. Or with something. So, for example, in Scotland, the Kalach is often found in Argyll and Bute. Why? Okay. She must like it a lot. I don't know. So you look at Ben Cruachan, the tallest mountain in the region. She is there, right? Mm-hmm. She also created Loch Awe, according to the folklore. So, you know, she was, before anything survived, she was tending sheep. She loves sheep. She loves animals. And she fell asleep. And then the well that was in the landscape overflowed and created the first river and loch. It's because she fell asleep. She was just doing her thing. She was walking around in the landscape, creating it accidentally. And yeah, and that's how stuff happens. And that's how things are made. Ben Nevis, heard from someone on the trail, is her mountain throne.
Good.
And on Isle of Skye, Ben na Chaiach, that's the hill of the old woman. And that's near the Coolin. So she inhabits those areas. She likes to go around those areas. These are her haunts. So when we're walking around, what we can do is we can go and knock on people's doors and ask them, where's the Kalach been?
Yeah. Or what's that mountain called?
Yeah. Is that
Ben the Kalach? Ah, I think we're close.
Yeah. And some guy would be like, well, actually, yeah, I saw a big foot go past my door this morning. You know? She says in a very Geordie accent instead of a Scottish accent.
We've got a bit further south.
She's also in Newcastle. England. Did you know that? God, she goes up and down the breadth of the country.
Well, and actually, but, I was going to ask that. So she mentioned, we've been talking about places in Scotland, but you mentioned she's quite big in Celtic mythology. So is she also in like Ireland and Wales and stuff as well?
She's definitely in Ireland. I'm not too sure about Wales, actually, but she's definitely in Ireland. There's many archaeological sites that are related to her. So wedge tombs, okay, such as Labacalli and Loncrew, County Meath, and passage tombs as well, called the Kayaks Mountain. And she tends to inhabit these passage tombs, these cairns. So they're often locally known as haunts for her. And so people will go to these areas and still, even to this day, perform certain rituals. There's one in, I believe, Dumfries, where she resided with her husband, Botoc, which means old man. And basically, they used to go in and all of her children would go in, and that's where they would live, and they'd have a fire. But there's stones on the outside. So in winter, they make sure the people, the local landscape, make sure that the stones have been moved to the outside so she can get in.
Oh, okay.
And then in summer, they move the stones back inside.
Yeah, so it really is, even if she hasn't done stuff herself, the way other people interact with the landscape is directly representative of how, whether or not her. She's there.
Oh. Yeah.
Very cool.
So we could find these tombs mm-hmm. and see if anything has moved and changed around it.
Oh, clever. Okay. So yeah, basically just, it's almost like a big scavenger hunt. Being like, right, here's a big loch, like a big lake. Let's see, are there sheep around? Like maybe she was sleeping or something. I mean, I know that happened a while ago. But like, or you know, that kind of thing. And then chatting to people a lot and asking about their experience of the landscape.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we could, you know, we've already knocked on a few doors, and then we could knock on a few more doors, and then a guy's like, well, actually, weirdly enough, that loch over there wasn't there before.
Oh.
And you're like, right, we're on the trail now. Mm-hmm. We're following her through the landscape. But lots of, place names are really, really important in this. So anything that you find that has the Kayak's name attached to it is her dwelling in some way.
Okay, yeah. Or even not necessarily Kayak, but anything related to old woman, old hag, like something along those lines, I guess.
Exactly. So a lot of the times when you, especially on in the Isle of Skye, when hikers are walking around the Coolins and stuff, that's actually her place. That's where she goes. This is her landscape and her home, you know, even though she creates the landscape. So we are interacting with folklore, and we're also interacting with the landscape kind of archaeological record in that place, because people are inhabiting it and they're interacting with the landscape in not necessarily even a domestic way, but in different activities.
Yeah.
That's how I think. That's the best way to try and track it down, the Kayak.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, that's really cool. I like that one.
Okay, fab. So I think we've sort of figured out how we're going to do it. Mm-hmm. And we've been walking around. We've been chatting to other people. Mm-hmm. We've been getting place names, and we've been looking at the landscape. Mm-hmm. So we stumble upon an ancient cairn, and it sits before us. As we approach, the frosted glen crunches under our boots. Our noses sting with the cold emanating from a crumbling dwelling. And even as we approach, the unnatural blue flame inside flickers across the lichen-encrusted stones. We're scared. Okay.
Okay. I mean, fear. It's the fear.
Healthy dose of fear. Emerging from the electric depths, a woman appears, firewood in hand, her face a deathly blue, and as her lone azure eye stares at us. Well, do you have my washing? The Kayak says.
The fear's voice, got to admit.
Yeah, I'm not very good at Scottish accents. Voice biting into us like hail on your cheek.
Oh, good work.
Shaking, I hold out the plaid to her. The still dirty plaid. But something in Tilly's mind stirs.
Ooh, something in my mind is stirring.
I'm Tilly. I'm going to have to ask you to roll an insight check.
Oh, okay. It's a 16.
Oh, you've passed the insight check. Whoa. Oh,
my goodness.
A very low insight.
Would have been
insight,
a very short episode otherwise.
Yeah.
I suddenly have this thought. Hang on, Ash. It's nearly spring, so if you give the Kayak her winter plaid, she'll wash it and bring in winter again.
Oh, the Kayak grins, caught out. You have passed the old hag's test. Fighting against the call of spring, she thought to wash the winter plaid again until it was white as fresh snow, urging in another winter storm. You have successfully thwarted the kayak's icy plan. She congratulates you on not being fooled by her or her trickster husband, Botok, and gifts you a piece of her firewood.
Oh, I get it now. Yeah, honestly, the insight check didn't help too much because I'm still there going, but wait, why wouldn't she watch it? I'm like, right, got it. Now I understand.
Oh, wait, okay, I get it now. You just have like a tingling spidey sense feeling.
Right? Yeah. I'm naturally smart, even though I don't realize it myself.
You're just intuitive. You just get people.
Yeah, luckily someone's written it all down for me so I can just read it out.
I wonder who that was. I'm the narrator, probably.
Okay, good. Well done, us.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, that's about it for this episode of And My Trial. I hope you enjoyed this quest. If there's any suggestions that people have for an episode that they've gotten from a fantasy book or have an archaeological concept that they don't understand that we might be able to help through fantasy, or something in a book that they want to find out more about from an archaeological viewpoint, do get in contact via email or social media. All contact info, as well as references and further reading for all the points we've discussed today, can be found in the show notes.
Oh, wow, Ash, look at the sky.
Oh, my God, that's beautiful. What is it?
I don't know, but I think we're going to find out.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.